Today we will talk about solutions to the Einstein equations other than Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker models. Just to show you that the horizon should be a little bit larger. I mean, our horizon, looking at cosmology, there is life beyond, there are exact solutions beyond complete homogeneity and isotropy. So the task is to solve the equations of motion of matter together with the Einstein equations. And here's the Einstein equation. Now, some people wonder, how many solutions are there to the Einstein equations? What could be the curvature of space-time? What are physical curvatures of space-time and which are forbidden by the Einstein equation? And the answer is, nothing is forbidden by the Einstein equation. You can write down any arbitrary metric, any arbitrary curvature, and it's okay with the Einstein equation. Just plug it into the left-hand side, and you will find that there's an angular momentum tensor for it. The big question is whether there is matter that is consistent with this energy momentum tensor, right? So you can always write down any kind of metric you want. It will produce a curvature tensor, it will produce an Einstein tensor, that will give you the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, and that means that space-time would take that metric if only you can find a reason for why there ought to be this energy momentum tensor. But of course, in general, not every energy momentum tensor will arise from reasonable matter. So it's a more subtle question. It's not like space-time can only take particular shapes because of the Einstein equations. It's that space-time can take any arbitrary shape, but can matter possibly produce the corresponding energy momentum tensor? So we really have to think of the problem as having to solve both the Einstein equations and the matter equations of motion. In practice, this is almost always way too hard because it's a highly nonlinear system of coupled equations. Therefore, in order to find exact solutions anyway, what we usually do is that we reduce the number of variables involved by assuming that there's symmetry. So let's ask now, how much can we weaken the symmetry assumptions that went into the Friedmann-Lemaître model and still find exact solutions? So assuming that the space-like hypersurfaces of space-time are isotropic and homogeneous, we were able to solve the Einstein equations. But maybe we can make fewer assumptions and still solve the problem. So here's the strategy then. Let us classify the cosmological models given by a space-time with a metric and an energy momentum tensor. Oh, it's much better, isn't it? So let us classify cosmological models by the amount and the type of symmetry that we assume. So we will quantify how much symmetry do we assume, and what are the cosmological models, therefore, that are compatible with these symmetries. Indeed, for any amount of symmetry that you assume, there are almost always exact solutions known, or at the very least, asymptotic behaviors of the exact solutions are known. And I think it is important that we study this, because as John Wainwright pointed out, who was, he's a retired professor in the Department of Applied Mathematics here, and he wrote a book together with George Ellis on the classification of cosmological models and on how to solve the Einstein equations using dynamical systems methods. He pointed out that there are exact solutions to general relativity, which have a little less symmetry than what we assume for Friedmann-Lemaître models, which deviate from Friedmann-Lemaître models dramatically at early and late times, if you like. OK? can adjust them in this way, but which also at some intermediate time come arbitrarily close to Friedland Lemaître solution. And that's possible because these equations are highly nonlinear. So surprising behaviors such as that do come up. In other words, the symmetry assumptions are not innocent at all. Let's remember some basics about symmetries in Killing vector fields. And then once we've reviewed the basics, we'll go beyond that and study a little bit Lie groups and Lie algebras. So two spacetimes given by a couple consisting of a differentiable manifold and a metric on it, and another differentiable manifold and another metric on it, two such spacetimes are called isometric, and they physically describe exactly the same shape of a spacetime if there is a diffeomorphism from the one manifold to the other, such that the image of G under that diffeomorphism happens to coincide with G tilde. In this case, when there is such a map, such a diffeomorphism, we say that the spacetime has a symmetry. I should add, if we find such a map from the manifold into itself that preserves the metric, then we say that the manifold has a symmetry. So for example, you see, this is a slightly more general statement. You have some differentiable manifold with a metric, some other differentiable manifold with a metric. You say that they are isometric if there's a diffeomorphism that maps the metric into itself. But here we are saying, imagine that M is M tilde. So you're mapping with a diffeomorphism the manifold into itself. So you already know that the diffeomorphism is just mapping from the manifold into itself. If then the metric doesn't change, then we say that the metric has a symmetry. So for example, imagine a manifold that looks a little bit like a cylinder. And so in particular, let's assume that it has a rotational symmetry. Well, then we can map this manifold into itself, M tilde is itself, but in such a way that we basically map this point into a point that we obtain by just rotating that entire cylinder. Could be like a can of a drink or something, just rotate it a little bit, and so every point of the manifold goes into another point of the manifold, and that's achieved by a diffeomorphism, which will actually map the metric into itself. So this can has a symmetry around some axis. It turns out that the set of all symmetries of a manifold always forms what is called a group. Let me quickly remind you of what a group is abstractly. A group is a set which has an operation which we may call little circle. And the little circle operation is such that you can take any two group elements and combine them using the circle operation, you get another group element. There's got to be a neutral element that we may call E. And we need to have associativity. We need to have that this neutral element is neutral from the left and from the right. And we require the axiom that there's always an inverse for each element of that set. Any set that obeys these few axioms is called a group. Now, such a set may have a finite number of members, of elements, but such a set could also have an infinite number of elements. It could even have continuous infinite number of elements, group elements. In fact, the set of group elements could form a differentiable manifold. If it does, then the group is called a Lie group.
But you need more than that, right? You need the group group operation to be also a diffeomorphism. Is that not?
Yeah, it has to be compatible with the diffeomorphic structure of the manifold. That's right. For example, the set of rotations in R3 forms a three-dimensional Lie group, and that group is called SO3. It is three-dimensional. How can we parameterize the group elements? For example, by two angles, that specify rotation axes. For example, one angle would be around the equator, another angle goes upwards or downwards, and the third angle is how much you actually rotate around that axis. So in this way, you can parameterize with three numbers, alpha, beta, gamma, any rotation. In general, the symmetries of a manifold don't always have to be a Lie group. They could be discrete, for example, reflections. A manifold could have a reflection symmetry. But often the symmetry group of a manifold is actually a Lie group. So notice that in this case, we have that each element of the group gives us an isometric diffeomorphism. That's by assumption. That's why we call it a symmetry. So every element of the group is a diffeomorphism, and that means in particular that every element of the group is mapping points of the manifold into points of the manifold. It maps every point of the manifold into another point of the manifold. So if we pick a group element and we pick a point of the manifold, then the group element maps that point of the manifold into a new point of the manifold. And the group element does that for the entire manifold. All points are moved to some other point. Just like on the can, you rotate every point to a new location. But what we can also do is that instead of holding H fixed and run through all possible P, we can hold P fixed and run through all possible H. So let us now consider the set O index P, which is the so-called, which is an orbit, which is defined to be this. O index P is the set of all points of the manifold, all points Q of the manifold, which can be reached from the point of the manifold H through the action of one of the group elements. So you pick a point P of the manifold, and then you apply your symmetry group elements on it. And that will map the point P into various places in the manifold. For every group, whenever you apply an element of the group to your point P, it is mapped to another point in the manifold, and in this way, you get an orbit. So O index P is called the orbit of P under the action of the group G. So for example, if you think of the can, the manifold in the shape of a can that we had earlier, the group consisted of the rotations of the can by arbitrary angles. You know, that's clearly a group because you can just rotate by two angles, and that's in total just the rotation by the sum of the two angles. There's always an inverse, there's a neutral rotation, and so on. And so what's the orbit then? You take a point of your can, the surface of the can, and then you apply a group element to it that will rotate it to some other location on the can.
It will be a circle. The orbit is a circle.
The orbit is a circle, that's right. Because you apply all group elements, all rotations to that point, so the orbit of each point is a circle. Not always the same circle, right? Because it depends where you, at what altitude you choose your point. Okay, so O index P is the orbit of a point under the action of the group G, of our symmetry group G. Now, if G, that's the general observation, if G is a Lie group, then each orbit of a point is a submanifold of our manifold. It's generally not the entire manifold, it's just some submanifold of it. Now, we were talking so far about so far about finite diffeomorphisms, group elements that were diffeomorphisms. What about infinitesimal symmetry transformations? What about infinitesimal isometric diffeomorphisms? Remember that in quantum mechanics, you can look at a translation operator that translates wave functions by a certain finite distance. But these translations are generated by an infinitesimal generator of infinitesimal translations, and that's the momentum operator. Here we have much more general things than translations. We have translations and rotations and boosts and all sorts of things. So far we considered finite ones. Let us now look at the infinitesimal ones. What kind of structure do they form? We know that the finite symmetry transformations form a group, generally a Lie group. Now let's look at the Lie derivative. Remember, the Lie derivative of a tensor is given by taking the tensor and covariantly differentiating it, contracting it with the direction vector in which you want to take the Lie derivative. And then you get a bunch of other terms with either minus signs or plus signs, and contractions either this way or that way, depending on whether the index in question is a contravariant or covariant one. The Lie derivative gives us the rate of change of a tensor along the flow of diffeomorphisms phi, which are generated by a vector field xi. So remember, xi, the direction vector in which we differentiate, is actually direction vector field, because we do it all over the place at once. And that direction vector field generates diffeomorphisms along the flow. So any direction vector field gives you a flow, at least for finite distance. And that flow induces the diffeomorphism of the manifold into itself. And the Lie derivative tells you how tensors change as you move along the integral curves of these flows. So let's do this now. We can use the Lie derivative to differentiate along the symmetry group orbits. So let's take the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of one of those vector fields. If the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of a vector field vanishes, it means that the metric tensor doesn't change as we travel along the flow generated by the vector field xi, and that's what we meant by a symmetry. The metric doesn't change under the action of the diffeomorphism, except that here, this is the action of an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. So we have a symmetry when the Lie derivative vanishes. But what is the Lie derivative of the metric? The Lie derivative of the metric is given by, well, it's a special case of what we had earlier for a more general tensor Q. The Lie derivative of the metric is given by the covariant derivative of the metric, contracted with k, and then two terms with a plus and contracted in this diagonal way because we have two covariant indices. Now that term is vanishing because the covariant derivative of the metric is always vanishing. That was the condition of the compatibility of the affine connection with the metric. So that's always gone. So we find that a vector field psi generates a symmetry of the space-time if it obeys that the sum of these two terms is vanishing. Because if the sum of these two terms is vanishing, then the Lie derivative is vanishing, so the metric is not changing in the direction of the flow. And that condition, of course, we've seen earlier, it's the Killing vector field condition. So how many Killing vector fields can there possibly be in a space-time? Let's say in a space-time of n dimensions. It turns out that the maximum number of Killing vector fields, and therefore of symmetries, and therefore of conservation laws, is n times n plus 1 half. So for example, in four dimensions, like 3 plus 1 dimensional space-times, we have 4 times 5, that's 20, divided by 2 is 10. How do we see that this is the right formula for the maximum number of killing vector fields? Well, here's a rough way to see that. Let us consider this equation here, the killing vector field equation that we have to solve. There are two ways in which this equation can hold. One way in which it can hold is that simply this term is vanishing anyway. So it's not a matter of cancellation between the two terms, but they just cancel anyway. So it could be, and that's one case, that psi mu semicolon nu is equal to zero for nu, which is to say that the absolute covariant derivative of psi is vanishing in no matter what no matter what direction you differentiate. Now, how many can we have of those? How many vectors can we have that obey that? Well, at any point, as many as there are dimensions in the manifold. So that's n. On the other hand, we can also have that these terms do not vanish, but they cancel each other. Now that means that this tensor here, viewed as a tensor, not as the covariant derivative of a tensor, but as an actual covariant to tensor, is antisymmetric. So if we define a tensor K mu nu to be psi mu semicolon nu, then that has to be an antisymmetric matrix in order to make that equation hold. So then we can check how many, what's the number of dimensions of the space of antisymmetric matrices. And that's, of course, n times n minus 1 half. Because you have to take away the diagonal, and then what is above the diagonal is mirrored below the diagonal up to minus sign. So then when you add up the n and the n minus 1 half, then you find that this is n times n plus 1 half. So we have maximally 10 independent killing vector fields. So the space of killing vector fields can be at most 10 dimensional in 3 plus 1 dimensional space-times. Otherwise, it can grow very quickly, in fact, quadratically, for higher dimensional space-times. Okay, so we were looking at finite symmetry transformations and infinitesimal symmetry transformations. And mathematically speaking, the finite symmetry transformations form a Lie group, the infinitesimal ones form a Lie algebra. Here's the general idea between Lie algebras and Lie groups. In principle, it's a huge field, and there could be a whole course on that. There should be, if there isn't. But just to give you the general idea, a Lie group is, as we said, a smooth manifold which has some extra structure. Namely, it has a multiplication. It's a manifold which has a multiplication which obeys the group axiom. Actually, the way I presented it just a few minutes ago was the other way around. I said start with a group and give it also a differentiable manifold structure. But either way, it's both a differentiable manifold and a Lie group in a way that is such that both structures are compatible with another. See, it's actually quite unusual for a smooth manifold to be a group too, because usually you can't just take any manifold and then expect that if you take two points of it, they can be multiplied. What does that even mean? Right? For space-time, it would certainly make no sense to say I take this event and I take that event and then I multiply them to get another event. But if the manifold is a symmetry group, then that's what you have. You have one point of the symmetry group, one point of the manifold, another point of the manifold. You can actually multiply them. So for example, as we said, the rotation group is a differentiable manifold, and it is a group. And it's a manifold because, as we said, three angles. You need three angles. It's a three-dimensional manifold because you need three angles to specify each rotation. The axis requires two angles, and then also the amount of rotation. And if you take two rotations, so you take two sets of angles alpha, beta, gamma to fix axes and rotations, then in total, if you can combine them, you can rotate in this direction that much, followed by rotating in that direction this much. This is actually, in total, just one rotation again around some other axis by some other angle. So it's again given by three numbers, alpha, beta, gamma. Anyway, so a Lie group is both a smooth manifold and it has a group multiplication on it. Now, take the part of the manifold. Let's consider the part of that group manifold which is close to the identity element. You see, it's a manifold with a particular element singled out. And that is, as a group, if you view the manifold now as a group, one of its elements, which is to say one of the points on the manifold, is actually the identity element in the group, such as the rotation by the angle of zero. That's one point in the group of rotations. And there are neighbors to it. And these neighboring points on the manifold are rotations about very, very small angles. Now, if you multiply them, then you get again a group element rotation by a small angle. So in the neighborhood of the identity element on the manifold of the group, the multiplication maps the neighborhood into the neighborhood. Because if you rotate by this angle, a tiny angle this axis, and then followed by rotating by tiny angle around that axis, that's still rotation by tiny angle around some axis. So now let's go to the tangent space of our manifold at the point which is the identity element of the group. The tangent space to the group manifold at the point which is the identity element of the group is a vector space, as all tangent spaces are, and it turns out that it has an extra structure. You see, the differentiable manifold is not just a differentiable manifold, it's a group too. And now we are looking at the tangent space of our differentiable manifold, and the tangent space is no longer just a tangent space. It inherits some structure, because the manifold is not just a manifold, the manifold is also a Lie group. So the tangent space is not just a vector space. It is a vector space, but it has extra structure on it that it inherits from the differentiable manifold. From the group multiplication. This is how we obtain what is called the Lie algebra. So we take the group manifold, we consider the tangent space of the manifold, to the manifold at the point which is the unit element in the group. And then that tangent space inherits some structure from the group multiplication, and that extra structure turns that tangent space into what is called a Lie algebra. It is a crucial fact that from knowledge of only the Lie algebra, so if you know only the tangent space, like the dimension of it, plus this extra structure that we'll discuss in a moment, then you can actually recover the group from that, the group that belongs to that Lie algebra. Also, sometimes you get more than you bargained for, because sometimes you can get, sometimes it may not be unique exactly the size of the group that you get by doing the opposite, by not going from the group to the Lie algebra, but going back from the Lie algebra to the group. Sometimes the group can be extended further than the group that you started with. So let's collect now the properties that the tangent space at the origin inherits from the multiplication of the group elements. It would take too long to actually derive these things. Let me just say, you take the group multiplication and you take the infinitesimal limit, where you go to points close to the origin, not the origin, close to the identity element, and take a limit. So a Lie algebra, which is a tangent space at the neutral element, a Lie algebra is defined now more abstractly as any vector space, be it from a construction like we just discussed, or more generally, it could be the starting point. A Lie algebra is any vector space A which has an additional operation, curly bracket, the so-called Lie bracket, which is the inherited version, the infinitesimalized version of the group multiplication. So a Lie algebra is any vector space which has an a binary operation which maps two elements of the Lie algebra, two elements of this vector space, into an element of that vector space again, which has the property that it is anti-symmetric and that it obeys the Jacobi identity. And it turns out that every Lie algebra that you can come up with is actually the Lie algebra that belongs to Lie group. Now, in particular, the set of Killing vector fields for a given space-time forms a Lie algebra. And that's a very useful thing to know because, as we discussed earlier, the set of diffeomorphisms is humongous. It is huge, and it's very difficult to parameterize it. It's very difficult to work with the entire set of diffeomorphisms. Even if you restrict attention to just the symmetry diffeomorphisms, just those that keep the metric the same, in cases where there are such, it's still an unwieldy object. It's just a huge set to work with. But the Lie algebra to a Lie group already contains all the essential information about the symmetry group. Therefore, it is much more convenient, generally, to work with the Lie algebra than to work with the Lie group. So it's good to know that the set of Killing vector fields is a Lie algebra. See, we ought to expect that because the Killing vector fields are the infinitesimal generators of symmetry. And so what we see here is that they live in the tangent space to the Lie group of all the symmetries. So what we have to show to see that is, for example, and I leave it to you as an exercise to work this out if you are interested. You need to show that if you take any two Killing vector fields, then any linear combination of the two of them is also a Killing vector field, which is to say also obeys the Killing vector field equation. Also, because that was one of the axioms of Lie algebra, it needs to form a vector space, right? So if the Killing vector fields are to form a Lie algebra, they must form a vector space. So the linear combination of any two Killing vector fields has to be a Killing vector field. It's not so hard to show that. But then you need to give the Killing vector fields a Lie bracket, a binary operation that obeys certain axioms. And we do it in this way. The Lie bracket of two Killing vector fields is defined to be the commutator of the two Killing vector fields. But you interpret each Killing vector field as a map, as a directional derivative that maps functions into functions. So if you apply Xi2 on a function, you get a function again, and now you can apply Xi1 to it. So with this definition, we now need to show that the Lie bracket is actually obeying all the axioms that the Lie bracket should obey, such as anti-symmetry, well, we can read that off right away, but also such as the Jacobi identity, but that's also not so difficult to check here.
This Lie bracket is essentially Lie derivative of one vector field along another vector field.
That's right, that came out as well, yes.
What's the significance of the Jacobi identity? I just don't remember what it is.
Oh, do you remember? You don't remember what it was?
I remember. Like, it's in the notes, but like, what is it? Why is it important?
It's essentially the integrability condition. You basically have to have that, just like with the momentum operator. When you exponentiate it, you get a finite translation. Now here, we want to allow ourselves not just momentum operators, but like angular momentum operators. So we want to be able to exponentiate them and then get finite rotations out of that. If we just take operators that have conditions like this, but are missing the Jacobi identity, then there's no guarantee that if you exponentiate one, exponentiate another, and you combine them, that you get another element of the set. So it's basically that integrability condition. There's another way to see why this is essential. Remember that when you take a matrix, when you take three matrices, square matrices, so endomorphisms of a vector space. Matrices are just linear maps from a vector space into itself, square matrices. And you write down the Jacobi identity for them. You will find that no matter what these matrices are, it's always obeyed. Remember the Jacobi identity? It was the bracket of A and B with C plus, and then two cyclic permutations is equal to zero. If you just write out the bracket as a commutator, as we do here, then all the terms just cancel each other out. You don't need to know what the matrices are. It's just automatically always the case. And that means that if something doesn't obey the Jacobi identity, it cannot be represented as a linear map. Not as a matrix, not as an operator on infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Cannot be done. Right? So it has to obey the Jacobi identity in order to have a chance to be represented as an operator. So let me quickly summarize the big picture here. The symmetries of any space-time, if it has symmetries, form a group. And that's because the symmetries can be concatenated, meaning performed one after the other, in a way that is associative, an essential condition for a group. And all symmetries possess an inverse. Some symmetries are differentiable and are parameterized by a flow. And these symmetries form a Lie group. So we are excluding here symmetries, discrete symmetries such as reflection symmetries, of which there are different kinds, right? You could do a reflection by a plane, reflection by an axis, reflection by a point. All those things could exist. Second point, each Killing vector field is the infinitesimal generator of a flow of isometric diffeomorphisms, that is, of a symmetry. So you can think of a Killing vector field as a fancy generalization of the momentum operator. The momentum operator can just stupidly translate in one direction and that's it. But Killing vector fields are generating symmetries that can be much more complicated. And they can correspond to translations in space, translations in time, mixtures of the two, rotations in space, rotations between space and time, which would be boosts, and combinations of all of that, if these are symmetries. And we saw that the Killing vector fields form a Lie algebra. And every Lie algebra generates a Lie group, and these were the finite diffeomorphisms. Now, there are two kinds of Killing vector fields. And just to give you an example of the two kinds, translations, they're basically translations and rotations. They're the generalized translations and the generalized rotations. Just like momenta and angular momenta are different, of different kind of categories. So there's a generalization of that distinction here too. And there are surfaces of homogeneity and the isotropy subgroups corresponding. So let's start with the definition. Let us denote by R the dimension of the Lie algebra of symmetries. And the dimension of the Lie algebra of symmetries is also the dimension of the Lie group of symmetries. Why would that be? The tangent space has the same dimension as the manifold, exactly. Okay, so the dimension of our Lie algebra, let's call it R. Now let's remember a definition that we had earlier. namely the orbit. Let us consider the set of points, the orbit, that the point P can be mapped into along the Killing vector fields, along the flow that is generated by the Killing vector fields. So this is to say by the symmetry group element, right? So you take a point of the manifold, and then by the each Killing vector field generates a diffeomorphism and a set of diffeomorphisms, a group of diffeomorphisms, and the point P of our manifold will travel on an orbit while these diffeomorphisms act on it. And let us give the dimension of that orbit a name. Let's call it S. So S is the dimension of the orbit of a point P under the action of the symmetry group. Now you may wonder, shouldn't this be the same? Couldn't it be that the dimension of the Lie algebra, the dimension of the Lie group, the dimension of the symmetries, shouldn't that be also the dimension of the orbit that every group element has? No, it doesn't have to be that. And that's because you can have, for example, a translation and rotation symmetries both together, right? So let's say your Killing vector fields are sometimes rotation, I mean, some of them are rotations, some of them are translations. Now take the point at the origin of your frame. Then the translations will give this point an orbit. It will move, the translations will move that point around. But the rotations will leave it the same. So the rotations are valid diffeomorphisms, describe a symmetry that comes with conservation laws, namely the angular momentum. And yet they don't contribute to making the orbit larger. So the dimension of the orbit is smaller than the dimension of the Lie group of symmetries, because some Killing vector fields don't actually move our point. So we have that S is always smaller or equal to R. Okay, so S is smaller or equal to R. And here's an example. In fact, I already told you the example. Consider a two-dimensional flat space, consider R2, two-dimensional flat space, and the point at the origin. Then R, the number of Killing vector fields, the number of independent Killing vector fields, which is to say the dimension of the Lie algebra of symmetries, the dimension of the Lie algebra spanned by the Killing vector fields, is actually maximal, because we have translation and rotation symmetries. All possible symmetries are there. Two translation symmetries in both directions, and any other that can be linearly combined from them, as well as rotations in the plane. So that's three. So the Lie algebra is three-dimensional, which is the max. Remember that the formula for the maximum number of independent Killing vector fields that you can have is n times n plus 1 half, which in two dimensions is 2 times 3 is 6 divided by 2 is 3. Okay. What are these Killing vector fields, by the way? Well, here they are. I mean, these are three Killing vector fields, and the Lie algebra of all Killing vector fields for R2 is simply the vector space spanned by these three vector fields. This vector field is generating translations in the x direction. You know, it's just like the momentum in quantum mechanics. This vector field is generating translations in the y direction, and that, of course, is generating rotations in the plane. So then, what's the orbit of the point at the origin? Well, the orbit of P, the orbit of the point at the origin, is R2. And that's because our diffeomorphisms can map P into any point in R2. You simply have to use a suitable linear combination of these two Killing vector fields, and they will translate our point P in any direction you want by any arbitrary amount. And so, yeah, you can move P to any point in the manifold, the orbit of P is the entire manifold. That's because these two guys generate the flow to everywhere. So what we say is that the surface of homogeneity has dimension S, which is 2, and that is smaller than 3, R equal 3. So the surface of homogeneity is the orbit generated by the Killing vector fields, which do not leave the point the same. So the surface of homogeneity is that submanifold in general, in this case it's the entire manifold, but in general that submanifold, which you can reach using the Killing vector fields, which do not leave the point the same. This Killing vector field just rotates, therefore leaves the origin at the same location. But these two are translating, and what they generate is called the surface of homogeneity. This is the origin of the statement that space-time in Robertson, Friedman-Robertson, Lemaître-Walker scenario, that the space-time is homogeneous. And remember, there is the statement that space-time is homogeneous. What we mean by that is it doesn't change as you travel along space-like hypersurfaces. So the space-time is spatially homogeneous. And then we also said it's isotropic, which means that it doesn't change when we rotate in any direction, right? So there's isotropy and there's homogeneity. In the case of Friedman-Lemaître, it seems like, well, why do we introduce two new words for this? But these two words, homogeneity and isotropy, we get to in a moment, have a more general technical definition. And the technical definition is that the surface of homogeneity is spanned by these guys, or is generated by these guys. And now we come to the isotropy subgroup in a moment. Right, so then what is the role of the third Killing vector field? It doesn't help generating a surface of homogeneity at all. The flow generated by K3 leaves P fixed and rotates everything else around P. So we say that those Killing vector fields which do not generate a homogeneity surface, so in this case it excludes K1 and K2, those Killing vector fields which generate therefore a trivial orbit for our point are generating what is called the isotropy subgroup, right? So the K1 and K2 are generating the homogeneity surfaces and K3 is generating the isotropy subgroup. In this case, it's all quite trivial, but in higher dimensions, with non-trivial symmetries, it's good to have those definitions to speak efficiently about these things. So then what is the dimension of the isotropy subgroup? Well, in our case, it's one, because there's just one Killing vector field that generates that. But in general, of course, it's just the Killing vector fields that are left over. After you took away those that move the point and called them the generators of the surfaces of homogeneity, then the remaining Killing vector fields generate the isotropy subgroup, and therefore in total we have that the sum of the generators of the isotropy subgroup and the generators of the surfaces of homogeneity is R, the total number. So the dimension of the Lie algebra splits into two. There is a contribution from the isotropy subgroup and a contribution from the homogeneous, from the generators of the surfaces of homogeneity. And roughly speaking, intuitively, we are splitting here into generalized rotations and generalized translations.
Sorry, yeah? Is the isotropy subgroup strictly just the Lorentz group part of the symmetry? Or and its subgroup, I mean?
It could be as large as that.
But it's basically up to the Lorentz group.
That's right. That's right. And in higher dimensions, the high dimensional generalization of it. So now we can attempt the classification of cosmological models according to the, not just attempt, it will succeed, it's a simple thing to do. We classify now cosmological models with regards to how many symmetries they have of each type. So the first thing we need to know is, or that we use to describe a cosmological model, is the dimension of its isotropy subgroup, D. So how high dimensional is the generalized rotation symmetry that it has? Now, if D is equal to zero, it means we have no rotations, no rotation symmetry at all. That would be the case that is called anisotropic. Then, for example, if D were equal to 1 for a particular spacetime, then if D is equal to 1, we have one rotational symmetry axis. So at each point in the manifold, we can have one symmetry axis. In the case where the dimension of the isotropy subgroup D is 3, and if you're dealing with 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetimes, if D is the three, if these three are space-like, then we have, for example, the spatially isotropic case, which would be the case of Friedmann-Lemaître cosmologies, where we assume that everything is rotation symmetric in space. There's this symmetry there. But in principle, we could have up to 6, right? Because the biggest number of Killing vector fields that we could possibly have, or the dimension of the largest Lie algebra of Killing vector fields that we could possibly have, is 10. Remember that was n times n plus 1 half. That's the max number of Killing vector fields that we can have. And in 3 plus 1 dimensions, this is 10. And the maximum number of translations in there is 4. So the maximum number of generalized rotations is 6, which is basically 3 rotational degrees of freedom and 3 boost degrees of freedom. And so, for example, we could have here the full Lorentz symmetry. On the other hand, another thing we need to know, or that we can use to classify cosmologies, is in addition to specifying how much isotropy the solution has, we can also ask how much homogeneity does it have. So we do that by distinguishing the dimension of the homogeneity surfaces. If S is equal to zero, we would say that this spacetime is inhomogeneous. So it has no translational symmetries. If, on the other hand, we have 3 spatial ones, for example, then we would call that a homogeneous spacetime, a spatially homogeneous spacetime. And at most, we could have 4 Killing vector fields, in which case we have translation invariance in space and time, for example, in Minkowski space. But this is not to say that you can only have the full symmetry if it's Minkowski space. You can also have the full symmetry in De Sitter space, for example. It turns out that a large body of literature exists on most cases that we used here for the classification. The dimension of generalized rotation symmetries and the dimension of generalized translation symmetries. There's a huge body of literature and many exact solutions are known. And sometimes the exact solutions may not be known, but the asymptotic behavior of such solutions can be derived. And if you're interested in that, I recommend this text by Wainwright and Ellis on the use of dynamical systems in cosmology, where there is quite an overview of this classification and the solutions that are known. So, for example, in the literature, you may find references to, for example, Einstein's static model or Gödel's model of cosmology or the Osworth Kerr models of cosmology, and then of course Friedmann-Lemaître, etc. models, Bianchi models and so on. And what is behind these names is really a simple classification. It's simply how many dimensions of homogeneity, how many dimensions of isotropy do we assume? So for example, in the Friedmann-Lemaître case, Friedmann-Lemaître ordinary cosmologies, we assume that we have three rotational symmetries and three translational symmetries.
If you have S equals 4, does that mean you have your energy conserved there on these models?
Generally, yes. Yes, you have a Killing vector field there. Time-like Killing vector field. Yes, and then you can look at models where, for example, you have extra homogeneity but loss of isotropy. Gödel's model, for example, would have these four homogeneity dimensions, which means that there's going to be a time-like and three space-like Killing vector fields, and you're going to have a conservation of momentum and energy, but you don't have much isotropy. There's Einstein's static model that has a lot of symmetries. And then on the other end of the spectrum, for example, Bianchi models have a lot of homogeneity, as much as Friedmann-Lemaître models, but no isotropy is assumed here. So these spacetimes would be looking different in different directions. But it doesn't matter where you go, it always looks the same. It's just the rotation symmetry that's broken. And you see, these things are not, these spacetimes are, amazingly, are not simply completely different from Friedmann-Lemaître models. They're all in the neighborhood of Friedmann-Lemaître models in some sense. Because even when you don't have a symmetry, you may have almost have that symmetry. And the crazy thing is that the Einstein equations are so nonlinear that what you can have is that, for example, space-time might be expanding in one direction at a higher rate than in another direction. And in the third direction, it might even be shrinking. While at the same time, the situation is not isotropic. it's not isotropic. It may depend on where you are, different places. So it can really be a bit like, I don't know, if you make a cake and your baking soda is not homogeneously distributed, I mean, anything goes. And these things influence each other, however. It's not like when in one direction the space-time is expanding very rapidly, it will automatically be independent of what the space-time does in the other dimensions. No, these things mix, of course. And so you can have an interaction between how much it wants to expand in the other direction or shrink and expand in yet another direction. All sorts of things can happen there. And because it's a nonlinear system, you can have wild behavior. There is a completely different way of classifying space-times as well, and I just want to give you the gist of it. Another way to classify solutions of the Einstein equation. Let's just close that. The idea here is to classify not directly the space-times, but to classify the energy-momentum tensors. Because remember, in principle, space-time, you can write down any metric and find that it is a solution of the Einstein equation. It just will produce, in general, some weird energy-momentum tensor on the right-hand side, and then you would have to explain why the energy-momentum tensor would have that weird form. So the idea here is to say, let us classify the possible energy-momentum tensors. Because classifying the possible right-hand sides of the Einstein equation means classifying the possible left-hand sides of the Einstein equation. So here's a proposition, namely that for any energy-momentum tensor, team mu nu, there exists a unique time-like vector field u such that the energy-momentum tensor takes this standard form, and that is more general than the standard form of a perfect fluid that we considered earlier. Namely, we can always write our energy momentum tensors in this way, that there's a scalar function here, and then there is this time-like vector field u here. Then we have that term where there's a scalar, and then the g mu nu plus ua ub. And then, well, these two terms we had from the perfect fluid case, where these had a particular relationship, energy density and pressure. But now, in the general case, we also have these possible terms and that term, where that is just a remnant tensor and these are vector fields. And one can show that in this general case, the decomposition can be done in such a way that this is a scalar, that's a vector field, that's a scalar, that's a tensor field, where they are not just general scalars, vectors, scalar, and tensors, but the vector field Q and the tensor pi obey these conditions, namely that Q is covariantly orthogonal to the time-like vector field U, and we have these conditions as well. That's just a mathematical result. This vector field U that comes up in that standard form of the energy momentum tensor is called the fundamental four-velocity field. Now, for example, we considered perfect fluids, where, remember, perfect fluid didn't have to be a fluid. It could also be a field, which just happens to have an energy momentum tensor of that form. Any matter that has this energy momentum tensor, or any quantum field that has that energy momentum tensor, is called by cosmologists a perfect fluid. So, for example, the perfect fluid special case of what we had earlier is the case where we have an energy density here, a pressure there, and the time-like vector field U.
But what if, let's say, my fluid is like a photon gas, then this fact, like,
it will not,
nothing null will go in here, right?
Yeah, the photon gas will not have that form. The energy momentum tensor of it will not have that form. For a scalar field, we saw that the energy momentum tensor has that form, but for photon gas, it will not. You can still fit it, of course, in the previous general formulation, but it will not fit here. Yeah. And remember, the equation of state was defined in this case, because in this case, we had only two free parameters, the energy density and the pressure. And then the pressure, we wrote down the pressure is equal to a parameter W times mu. In general, of course, there's no reason for W to be a constant. It's just that, as it happens in cosmology, there have been long epochs of evolution of the space-time in which W was essentially constant. For example, the radiation, the period of radiation domination, the period of matter domination, the period of cosmonautical constant domination. And since it was constant, that parameter is then also called the equation of state constant, or in general, equation of state parameter. Sometimes cosmologists use not the variable W, but instead they use the variable gamma minus 1, which is W, so the deviation from 1. Gamma is the... W would be the deviation of gamma from 1. And in the case of W being equal to 0, which would be the case of dust, we would have that gamma is equal to 1, and then gamma is 4/3 for radiation, 0 for cosmological constant. We discussed already the evolution of the equation of state parameter W, and just to remind you, the current understanding, the current standard model of cosmology says that the W parameter over time behaved in this way. Here, just plotted W from the Big Bang to today. So today, the W parameter is very small. I mean, by that I mean close to minus 1, possibly even smaller than minus 1, possibly hinting at a big rip. But before that, it wasn't like that at all. And at some point, we had dust model. We had dust domination in the universe, in which case the W was zero. And then before, we had radiation domination, where W was a third. And then even earlier, we had this inflationary period was where it was close to minus one again. So for some reason, the W parameter in the universe seems to have an oscillation here, and therefore it's really premature to think that it would settle there. It might just go for reasons unknown yet, it might just change its value further on. Anyway, that was just a quick review. So now, a definition related to this time-like vector in the general case. This was the case of Friedmann-Lemaître models, where the energy momentum tensor is simply of that form. But in general, for the general energy momentum tensor that I wrote down on the previous slide, we have that the space-time may have a full homogeneity, so it will have three dimensions of space-like homogeneity, but the fundamental velocity field, U, may not be orthogonal to it, may not be orthogonal to the surfaces of homogeneity. And in that case, just to introduce to you that term, because you will find it in the literature if you want to review these things, in that case, you will say that these cosmologies are tilted. Okay, so we are after a systematic classification of the energy momentum tensor. And the mathematics of it is quite non-trivial, and it's easy to misunderstand what's going on here. In principle, you might think, well, it's easy because the energy momentum tensor is a symmetric matrix. And therefore, if I just let loose ordinary linear algebra, I will quickly have a classification. And that's because any symmetric matrix can be diagonalized, and I can just look up the eigenvalues, and that will tell me pretty much everything I need to know about that. In quantum mechanics, that would be true for the Hamiltonian and any other observable. But here, this is not how it works at all. And the reason is that this is a symmetric metric, all right, symmetric tensor, all right, symmetric matrix, all right, but the inner product in that vector space is not trivial. The inner product is given by the metric. And the metric is not positive definite. And that means that this matrix, T mu nu, is not actually self-adjoint. It would be self-adjoint if the vector space on which it acts when you view it as a matrix, acting on a vector space of column vectors, if that vector space of column vectors had a positive definite inner product, then we could say, yes, that one is symmetric, so it's self-adjoint, so the spectral theorem kicks in, therefore we can diagonalize it with real eigenvalue. But no, the vector space on which this thing acts, which is the tangent vector space, has as its inner product the metric, which is not even positive definite. Therefore, T mu nu is generally not Hermitian. Of course, for the perfect fluid case, it's diagonal to start with. We don't have to worry about it. But we are now looking at the really generic case, where the T mu nu is not diagonal. And what we see here is that we cannot rely on the spectral theorem as a consequence of the symmetry to show that there is a change of basis in the tangent spaces such that T mu nu becomes diagonal with real eigenvalues. Now you might say, okay, we can fix this easily. I just raise one index. And when I raise one index, then the inner product of the vector space on which this is acting now, or from which it is mapping into itself, the inner product becomes now trivial, because the G mu nu with one index up, one index down, is a conical delta mu nu. So now we are in business. That's just an ordinary positive definite in a product in this way, just viewed as a purely linear algebra thing. But the trouble is that the team you knew with one index up and one index down is no longer symmetric. It's generally simply not symmetric. It's not the same thing if you interchange mu and nu. So now we've lost that. The signature of the inner product is fine now, but the matrix is no longer symmetric. So what is the best we can do? In such a case, the best we can do is to choose a basis such that the team you knew acquires what is called the Jordan normal form. Do you remember that from linear algebra? It's almost diagonalization, but you have these extra ones on the off diagonal, just next to the diagonal. So like, yeah, it's like slightly upper triangle, slightly upper triangular stuff. That's the best you can do. But it's standard stuff. You can do this Jordan normal form. And when you apply the Jordan normal form decomposition to the energy momentum tensor team you knew, then what you get is called the Segre classification. And it yields, the Segre classification gives you four main types of energy momentum tensors. So we won't go into all of the linear algebra and the Jordan normal form. I'd like to give you the gist of it. I would say more about this a little later. So let's remember what the strategy was. We wanted to classify the possible energy momentum tensors because via the Einstein equation, that would give us a classification of possible curvatures. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the Einstein equation can actually also be written in this form. I'm not sure if you've seen that before, but that is another way of writing the Einstein equation, which is completely equivalent. How would you get back to the usual Einstein equation? Well, you take the trace of it. So you contract that with the G mu nu, then you get an expression for R, for the Ricci tensor on the left, and you get the T here, and so on. And then you can plug that expression for R in there, and you can solve the equation again, and it just works out nicely that when you do this contraction, because you see, if you contract that with G mu nu, you get here the Ricci tensor, but here you get a contraction of G with itself, right? And when you do that, you get 4, right? Because you can use the G with the lower indices, and then you have the G with the upper indices, because that's what you need for the contraction. You can use that to raise one index up, and then you take the trace. And so you have the Kronecker delta with equal indices summed over, so you get a 4. And that just gives you a total factor of 2 in 3 plus 1 dimensions, gives a total factor of 2, and that means you can solve that equation now to express T mu nu in terms of R and the Ricci scalar. It's a weird but beautiful thing that this happens in 3 plus 1 dimensions only. If you assume that space-time has any other number of dimensions, then the Einstein equation cannot be put into this form. You see, this is a beautifully self-dual way of writing the Einstein equation. Imagine you replace T and R here. Then you would have T mu nu equal to a constant times R mu nu minus 1/2 G R, which is the Einstein equation, right? So what we see is that the Einstein equation is self-dual in the sense of that it has a symmetry under the exchange of T and R only in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Well, you would also have it in 2 plus 2 dimensions, but it's got to be a four-dimensional manifold in total. Anyway, what we see here is that if we classify the T's, we classify the R's. If we classify the R's, we classify the T's. I would really recommend to play with this. Try to solve that for the Einstein equation, or get at that from the Einstein equation, and see how the dimension dependence comes into it. I have not seen this fact of self-duality having been made use of, but I think it could be something deep. Okay, so What do we have? We have here that the energy momentum tensor determines the Einstein tensor, but as this equation shows, the energy momentum tensor determines not only the Einstein tensor, the energy momentum tensor also determines the Ricci tensor. The energy momentum tensor has 10 degrees of freedom because it's a symmetric matrix, symmetric 4x4 matrix, which means that the energy momentum tensor determines the 10 degrees of freedom of the Ricci tensor. But gravity has 20. The energy momentum, the Riemann curvature tensor, with its full number of indices, with 4 indices, actually has 20 degrees of freedom. The Ricci tensor has only 10. And they can be classified by the energy momentum tensor, but not more than that. So we are missing out on something. If, by using the Jordan normal form, we classify the possible energy momentum tensors, we are only classifying the possible Ricci tensors, which is only half of the degrees of freedom of gravity. We are missing out on something.
So are we strictly missing the traceless part?
Basically,
because you contract the Ricci.
Yes. Yes, let's get to that. So we find that the segregated classification of possible energy momentum tensors using the Jordan normal form gives us, via the Einstein equation, also a classification of the Ricci tensors R mu nu, but does it also give us a classification of the possible Riemann tensors? No. And that's because the Ricci tensor contains only 10 of the 20 degrees of freedom of the Riemann tensor. So here's a proposition. The information in the full Riemann curvature tensor is shared among the Ricci tensor and some other thing that we cannot capture with the energy momentum tensor. And that is the so-called Weyl curvature tensor. Let me just get back to this for a moment. What we are seeing here is that energy and momentum, or generally matter, is impacting curvature, but the Einstein equation only tells us how it is impacting on Ricci curvature. It's not telling us how it's impacting Weyl curvature. Weyl curvature is independent of that. So at every point in space, the Ricci tensor is determined by the presence of matter. From this we can draw, for example, a very quick conclusion. Take a black hole, a Schwarzschild solution, for example. There is no matter, except possibly at the singularity in the middle. But out, away from the singularity, there is no matter. The energy momentum tensor is zero for the Schwarzschild solution. But if the energy momentum tensor is zero, we can immediately conclude that there is no Ricci curvature, right? Because the Ricci curvature at every location is given by this expression in terms of the energy momentum tensor. So the Schwarzschild solution has no Ricci curvature, and yet it's highly non-trivial. A black hole may suck you in. It's not doing it with Ricci curvature at all, because all outside the black hole, there is no Ricci curvature. The Ricci curvature tensor is zero. No, it's Weyl curvature that sucks you in.
This is one application of this duality, right? Because if you write an original equation, you can only conclude that the Ricci tensor is proportional to Ricci scalar.
That's right. In general, you can only conclude, because in general you have that energy momentum tensor is equal to Einstein tensor, you can only conclude that the Einstein curvature is vanishing, that the Einstein tensor is vanishing. But now we can conclude that both the Einstein tensor and the Ricci tensor are vanishing. So we arrived here. We said that the information that is in the Riemann curvature tensor is definitely more than the information that's contained in the Ricci tensor, because the Ricci tensor doesn't even know that there's a black hole. It's zero in the background of a black hole. So the full information that is in the Riemann curvature tensor is distributed. It's partially in the Ricci tensor and partially in the Weyl tensor. You need to know both of them to be able to recover what the Riemann curvature tensor is. Now, it's a little tedious to... wait a moment. It's a little tedious to prove these things. So let me just flash what the outcome is. So the Weyl tensor has four indices, just like the Riemann curvature tensor has. And the Weyl tensor is given in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor in this way. So basically, the Weyl curvature tensor is the Riemann curvature tensor minus the Ricci part of it. So all of this is basically the Ricci part of the curvature tensor. Notice that here's the Ricci scalar, and here's the Ricci tensor, right? So if the Ricci tensor is zero, then all of that stuff goes away. And we say that, well, if the Ricci tensor is zero, then the Weyl tensor has everything. The Weyl tensor is equal to the Riemann curvature tensor. So it had to be something like that. But the coefficients, you know, have to work it out. So when the Ricci tensor is given and the Weyl curvature tensor is given, then indeed, together they determine the Riemann curvature tensor. Namely, the Riemann curvature tensor is, just solving that equation for the Riemann curvature tensor, is given by the Weyl curvature tensor plus this stuff in terms of the Ricci tensor. So, as it says here in the box, the Riemann curvature tensor can be expressed through the Weyl curvature tensor and the Ricci tensor, both of which a careful counting shows have 10 independent components. So the Weyl tensor contains all that information that the Ricci tensor doesn't. The Ricci tensor knows everything about matter, and the Weyl curvature tensor knows everything that has nothing to do with matter.
But that means Weyl curvature only contains the part that doesn't change volume.
That doesn't change what?
Volume.
Yeah, we get to that next. Just a sec. Okay. So, the Weyl curvature tensor describes all that curvature which can exist even when there is no matter. Right? Like the curvature in the neighborhood of Earth. There is curvature even though there's no matter. And that curvature is described by Weyl curvature, just like the curvature in the neighborhood of a black hole. Or even in an expanding space-time, if there is no matter. Wherever there's no matter, but there is some non-trivial curvature, it must be Weyl curvature. Here's a proposition. Assume that MG is a space-time. So it's a 3 plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian manifold. Now, let us choose any smooth positive scalar function, and I'm getting to Erikson's point now. Choose any positive scalar function phi, which will have the role of being of generating a conformal transformation. So choose any smooth positive scalar function phi, and then define the manifold, which is given by the same differentiable manifold as before, but a different metric. And the different metric, the new metric G tilde, is obtained from the old metric G by multiplying it with phi of x. So the two manifolds are definitely different. They are not isometric at all. They have the same differentiable manifold structure, but the metrics differ by this scalar factor, which of course will change all volumes in particular that you may want to measure, because this definitely will multiply the volume form. Now, what one can prove is that, amazingly, the Weyl curvature tensor does not change when you do this conformal transformation. So under any conformal transformation, the wild curvature tensor will not change. What this means is, if we put it together with our, you remember that in this course, one of the perspectives that we pursue is, what are the different ways that we can describe the shape of a manifold? Because one of those ways must be the right one to do quantum gravity, right? Nobody knows which one it is, but we've looked at many different ones, and now we are seeing yet another one. Let's combine that with something we saw a few lectures ago. We saw, or was it just, yeah, no, just last lecture. We saw that if you know at every point of the manifold where the light cones are, where the light cone is, then you already know the metric up to a conformal factor. So if you know the causal structure of your space-time, then you know it completely up to a scalar factor. And so what this is telling us is that the wild curvature is insensitive to the scalar factor. It is only caring about the causal structure. Wild curvature cares about the causal structure but doesn't know anything about that extra part that you need to fully describe a space-time. So it, I guess that's what you were referring to earlier. Let me make a little historical remark. Consider the equivalence class of space-times that are conformally equivalent to Minkowski space. So consider all those space-times described by metric tensors that are conformally related to Minkowski space. Such as, for example, the Friedmann-Lemaître models, as we showed. If you use conformal time and co-moving coordinate systems, then the metric tensor is just proportional to eta mu nu. So let us consider the equivalence class of space-times that are conformally equivalent to Minkowski space. Einstein and Fokker initially considered a theory of gravity which wasn't general relativity yet, in which the metric didn't have the full set of degrees of freedom that we now associate with it, but instead where the metric was allowed to have only this degree of freedom. So they considered a kind of general relativity in which gravity could manifest itself only in terms of this. So the metric tensor had to be always eta mu nu times something else. It's a very simple gravity which has only one degree of freedom at every point. And the idea was, of course, that phi generalizes in some way Newton's gravitational potential. In this case, what do you get? Well, they wrote down the action in the usual way with the Ricci scalar here, and then you add the matter action to it, and you can calculate now what the equations of motion are of matter and of space-time, but you require that G has to be of this form. In other words, it's not G with respect to which you're varying here, you're varying with respect to phi. You're putting all of this in here and then do a variational principle with respect to phi. And the phi determines your Ricci scalar. See, the Ricci scalar sees the scalar factor because the Ricci scalar is from Ricci curvature. It sees this scalar. And then the Einstein equation, or let's call it the Einstein-Fokker equation, was that the Ricci scalar is 8 pi g t mu mu. It's a scalar equation rather than the tensorial equation that we now use. It turns out that the equivalence principle is okay with this. It's fully diffeomorphism invariant and all that. But it turned out that when they calculated the bending of light and the shift of the perihelion of Mercury, they came out wrong. So they knew it was a wrong theory. And then Einstein upgraded it to allow for the full freedom in the metric there.
But that's only true in four dimensions, right? EM field is only conformal in dimension four.
Yes, but I think even true. But I think it still would have been wrong anyway, even if space time was five dimension. It just wouldn't have been so easy to see, I guess. So remember, via the Einstein equation, the Segre classification of the energy momentum tensors gives us a classification of properties of the Ricci tensor. And ultimately, mathematically, it was just boiling down to the Jordan normal form for a matrix. So that can be done, but that only classifies 10 degrees of freedom. We still have 10 degrees of freedom left, the ones of the Weyl curvature. So how do we then classify the Weyl tensor? And that is done in the so-called Petrov classification. This is a classification of Weyl tensors. And they possess, as we discussed, 10 degrees of freedom. 10 go to the Ricci scale, Ricci tensor, and 10 to the Weyl tensor. And the Riemann curvature tensor has 20. Now, it turns out that the Weyl curvature tensor, when you take two indices up and two indices down, then this Weyl curvature tensor has a property just like the Riemann tensor, namely that it is antisymmetric in the exchange of mu and nu, it is antisymmetric in rho and epsilon, and it is symmetric under the exchange of these two by those two. What that means is this. It means that you can view this as an endomorphism that maps antisymmetric matrices into antisymmetric matrices, right? Because you can view this as a double index. That is a double index. So you can view this as one index, and that is one index, and it's a map which is symmetric because you can interchange the two. It's a symmetric map, like a self-adjoint map. But from where to where? Well, from the space where these guys live in, and that is the space of antisymmetric contravariant two tensors. So therefore, the Weyl curvature tensor can locally be viewed as a symmetric map from the antisymmetric part of the space of contravariant two tensors, so-called bivectors, into itself. However, as we discussed earlier, there can be a problem with the inner product. And it turns out that the inner product in this space is not necessarily positive definite. It is if the spacetime is a Riemannian spacetime, but it's not if it's Lorentzian. The indefinite nature of the metric is screwing things up. So therefore, C, that symmetric map here, is generally not Hermitian. So even though it is symmetric, it's not Hermitian or self-adjoint because the inner product in that space is not positive definite. So, again, we use the Jordan normal form to classify the Weyl curvature tensor. And the outcome, I mean, it would be too tedious to go through the details of this, but the outcome is the finding that there are six main classes, so-called Petrov classes, for Weyl curvature, according to the eigenvalue, eigenvector decomposition of the Weyl curvature term. And what are they? Well, in brief, they are these. There is type 0, which means, well, there is no Weyl curvature. And then there is type D, which is so-called static Weyl curvature. And that would be the curvature that is, for example, present at the outside of a black hole or a star, even inside the black hole, just not the singularity. Wherever there is no matter, in the case of a star or a black hole or a planet, the outside the matter distribution, if it's a static situation, just as like outside the singularity of Schwarzschild black hole, then that curvature is of type D Weyl curvature. Because it's massless, it must be Weyl curvature, and because it's static, it's the type D type N wild curvature is transverse gravitational waves. This is the type that LIGO is now detecting. And this type of wild curvature, these gravitational waves behave and dilute in the same way that electromagnetic radiation would, except that it's spin 2 and therefore it has a more complicated polarization structure. And then there is also longitudinal gravitational waves. Now, longitudinal gravitational waves cause a shear-like effect. We will get to see more about the shear later on. In any case, these waves cause a shear effect, but they decay much faster than the type N gravitational waves. Type N gravitational waves are gravitational waves that can travel very far. The type I gravitational waves, longitudinal gravitational waves, decay very quickly. And they have to, because this is basically a near-field effect. If you are very close to two neutron stars that orbit each other, then you have so-called near-field effects, including that kind of wild curvature. Whereas, and you know, because it decays very quickly, it's called near-field. If you are at a significant distance, only that kind of curvature survives. This situation is very similar to electromagnetism. An antenna, exactly. When you are close to an antenna, like an antenna the size of this hockey stick, then you get all sorts of electric and magnetic fields. And in this case, you can't really say that I only have photons that have only transversal degrees of freedom. In the near field, it doesn't make sense, because it's not yet self-sustaining waves that happen in the near field of an antenna. Instead, what you see is just the electric and magnetic, the electrostatic and magnetostatic fields that come about because charges are racing up and down the antenna and currents are flowing and they generate electric and magnetic fields. In the far field, in a far distance from the antenna, the electric field that you see is not the electric field that the antenna produced. When you're far away from the antenna, the magnetic field that you may see is not the magnetic field that the antenna produced. No. Far away from the antenna, electric fields and magnetic fields keep inducing each other. An electric field decays, produces a magnetic field, which decays, produces an electric field, and so on. And these are traveling waves. And these are then properly described as photons. But when you're very close to the antenna, you not only get the electric and magnetic fields that have been induced by decaying electric and magnetic fields, you also see the electric and magnetic fields that are electrostatically present just because of the charges and the currents that are very nearby. But of course, that effect decays very quickly. And so similarly with gravity, you get all sorts of gravitational effects if you are close to the source. But further away, you only get the effects of the self-sustaining part of the gravitational waves, so further away you only get the type N, but if you're really close, you get the type I as well.
So this is beyond Wakefield limit, that when I do linearized gravity, I cannot get this from linearized gravity, right?
I don't think you can, yeah. Right. Okay, and then finally there's a potential problem with symmetry assumptions, namely, the so-obtained highly symmetric solutions, for example, Friedmann-Lemaître, may possess properties that are peculiar to high symmetries. So, for example, when a Friedmann-Lemaître solution or Schwarzschild solution exhibits a singularity, we have to ask, is that singularity due to the symmetry, or is it really happening? Would the singularity also happen if we didn't have that high symmetry? For example, remember, in principle, consider a figure skater, and she has some rotation on the ice, and then she pulls in her hands and she goes very, very fast. Similarly, you could imagine that when a universe contracts, that the matter starts spinning very, very fast. If it had any initial rotation, it would start spinning very, very fast, and then it's not clear that you still get a singularity. You could have the things flow apart again, just because of the huge rotation and angular momentum conservation, if there were such a thing as angular momentum conservation in general. So in principle, it's not obvious that the singularities, the cosmological singularities, or the singularities of black holes really are there generically. They may be an artifact of the symmetries that went into the calculations. The solutions may not be stable under small perturbations. After all, the equations are highly nonlinear. And that's where Hawking came in and his PhD thesis. He and some others calculated that singularities can be unavoidable. So even though you may not be able to solve the problems exactly, you can show, or Hawking showed, that if you make certain assumptions about the properties of the energy momentum tensor and the initial setup of the situation, then things will have to evolve in such a way as to produce a singularity. So symmetries are fine and super important because we can get exact solutions and study them, but they have to be supplemented with studies of stability. And we will look into that next. Okay, I think we're done for today, if I remember correctly. Yep, we are. Okay.